Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The effects of climate change are growing more destructive and costly every year. Stronger and deadlier hurricanes like Hurricane Melissa, along with extreme heat waves, prolonged droughts, melting ice caps, and accelerating species loss are clear signs that we have to find solutions to solve this crisis. In its latest emissions gap report, the UN Environment Program warned that the world is on track to exceed the 1.5 degrees Celsius warming limit. Based on current policies, global temperatures could rise by as much as 2.8 degrees Celsius, locking in catastrophic and irreversible damage. The report says the science is unequivocal. We cannot stop the catastrophic climate scenario if we continue burning fossil fuels. But what does a just green energy transition look like? Can we solve the climate crisis under the existing capitalist system? In her new book, Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism, today's guest, Professor Thea Riofrancos, says lithium is essential to addressing the climate crisis. The renewable energy transition depends on electrification, and electrification depends on rechargeable batteries, especially for electric cars. She writes that if we're to have any chance of avoiding the most catastrophic climate scenarios, we have no choice but to slash carbon emissions, especially in transportation. The transportation sector is the single largest contributor to the U.S. carbon footprint and the second largest source of global carbon emissions. Lithium batteries are essential for the energy sector, but extracting lithium comes at escalating social and environmental costs. Thea Riofrancos asks a very important question. Is it possible to save the world by harming it in the process? Thea Riofrancos is political science professor at Providence College with interest in resource extraction, renewable energy, green technology, social movements, and the left in Latin America. She's also strategic co-director of the Climate and Community Institute, a progressive climate and economy think tank. In her new book, Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism, Thea Riofrancos takes us across three continents to explore the landscape, social movements, public policies, geopolitical conflicts, and corporate strategies that are shaping the extractive frontiers of the energy transition. Hi, Professor Riofrancos. Thank you so much for your important book and your work, and thank you for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. First off, can you tell us, how did you become interested in specifically looking at lithium mining?
Yeah, it's a bit of a story, but I'll try to keep it short. Basically, for a long time, as you mentioned, I have worked on extractive sectors. So these are oil and gas and coal and mining sectors, any sector where we're kind of digging something up from out of the earth and then using it in other supply chains or as a source of energy. And I've been long interested in these sectors because they are very socially contentious. They're obviously environmentally impactful. There's a lot of interesting politics around them, both in terms of governments promoting these sectors for development or national security, but also in terms of inspiring social movements and really interesting ideas for how to govern them better. So I've always been attracted to looking at resource extraction and all of its difficulties and dilemmas. But with this book, what I wanted to do is connect that to my passion for climate organizing and a just transition to a renewable energy system. I wanted to challenge myself to take seriously some of the environmental impacts of that transition, also the ways that it could be designed better by really zooming in on one of the most uncomfortable aspects of the transition, which is that some environments will likely be harmed and are already being harmed in the goal of promoting renewable energy supply chains. I wanted to take that contradiction seriously, but not get paralyzed by it. Understand how we can move ahead without so much environmental harm while still addressing our climate goals.
You do really an incredible job of connecting the dots. And we're, in some cases, in the beginning of what's to come, and the demand is just exploding for these minerals. Most people have not seen or visited a lithium mine, and for your work, you went to Chile, Portugal, and then the United States to really look at lithium extraction. You write that lithium is the third element in the periodic table. It's the lightest, least dense metal, although it's never encountered as such in nature, as it's too reactive to exist without being bonded in a compound. Lithium ions and minerals appear in an impressive range of environments, hard rocks, liquid brine, soft clays, even the ocean. So tell us more about lithium and what we need to know, because even those of us who have electric cars or might want an electric car in the future probably don't know much about lithium.
Exactly. And, you know, just to put it on the record, I myself own an electric car, and that's because my old, you know, traditional car, the transmission died a few years ago, and I didn't feel comfortable as a climate activist buying a gasoline-powered car in 2023, which was the year that that happened. So I went for an electric vehicle, but with a lot more awareness than the average person might have about some of the environmental costs of my decision. You know, though I do say, and I want to make this clear, that electric mobility is better for sure in addressing the climate crisis than traditional cars. We have to move to electric, but the question is, how do we electrify mobility in a way to reduce all of these environmental harms as much as possible? So I'll say a word about why lithium is important, though you did such a good job explaining it already in the intro, and then I'll talk a little bit about the landscapes affected by lithium mining. So lithium is essential to decarbonizing the transportation sector. That sector, as you mentioned, is our number one source of carbon emissions in the United States, which itself speaks to how car-dependent a society we are. Globally, the transportation sector is the number two most important source of emissions after the energy sector. So the fact that it's number one in the U.S., again, owes to the fact that so many of us drive cars, and the vast majority of those cars pollute the air with carbon. And so lithium is essential there, because lithium batteries can power electric vehicles, electric buses, electric bikes. I want to add one other thing, especially because I'm speaking to a California audience where this is particularly important. Really big lithium batteries, like bigger than would be in an electric vehicle, also serve another purpose, which is stabilizing and storing renewable energy on energy grids. So on an electricity grid, you can store solar energy when the sun isn't shining, or wind energy when the wind isn't blowing, and then deploy it hours later. So lithium batteries also play a key role in our energy sector. And so we can see why they are important. I call them the MVP of the energy transition, right? The most valuable player. But we need to look closely at how lithium is mined and what particular communities and landscapes it affects. Right now, Chile is the number two producer of lithium for global markets. It supplies about a fifth of global lithium supplies. And all of that comes from the Atacama Desert, which is a beautiful, absolutely unique, spectacular landscape that is so gorgeous that it's one of Chile's top tourist destinations. Just to give you a sense of, you know, again, the beauty of the landscapes that are at potentially being sacrificed as lithium mining and demand for lithium explodes. This is a very dry desert, and that might sound redundant. All deserts are dry, but it's the driest desert on Earth. And lithium mining, and the lithium there, as I describe in the book, is in salt flats. It's underneath the salt flats, these beautiful, enormous expanses of salt crust in these highly rugged kind of mountain environments. Underneath those salt flats, there is lithium brine. That brine is pumped to the surface and evaporated using just natural solar radiation, natural evaporation processes, and then further concentrated into a lithium-rich liquid that will then be chemically refined. And, you know, the mining companies there say that there's no problem. We're just getting rid of some salt water that no one uses anyway. But as many scientists have shown, and as indigenous and environmental activists have also demonstrated, this has a profound effect on biodiversity and the broader hydrological system of the desert, because the salt water and the fresh water, both underground in aquifers, are actually connected to one another. Removing massive quantities of salt water draws down the fresh water and makes it harder to access Already we see declining flamingo populations. We see, now decades now, violations of indigenous rights and the lack of consultation when these projects first started. And we've seen lots of protests over the years, including in the past year, against these lithium projects, right? So they are environmentally impactful and socially contentious. Beyond Chile, lithium is expanding everywhere as governments and corporations promote the sector. And so, as you mentioned, I traveled to Europe and the United States, two places that might seem a little unexpected because neither are the major suppliers of minerals of any sort for the global market. Both of them overall tend to import minerals rather than extract them domestically. But because of this major push for critical minerals, both the European governments and American government under both Biden and Trump have really promoted lithium mining as well as other mining sectors relevant to the energy transition. So I traveled to Portugal and Nevada to see places where the mining hasn't started yet, but the landscapes have been slated for mining. There are projects proposed and under development, and the protest is already heating up, and the contention over environmental impacts is already quite high. And so I think it's helpful for the reader to explore both places that have already been impacted, but also where there might be new projects and there's already concern and contestation.
We do our best to talk about these issues on a regular basis and make connections between the choices that we make, the things that we buy, and the people who are connected to that, the land that is connected to that. And I think this is a really important point that you make. You write, we in the United States are implicated in the supply chains that start in Chile's northern reaches. Achieving a globally just energy transition requires understanding supply chains in reverse, starting from what we produce and consume and working backward to their material inputs and further still to the relentless scramble for new extractive frontiers. I think this is so important. Important, especially at a time when people are consuming so much. We see the delivery vans, the Amazon vans, pass us on a regular basis. It's also very important, and you write about this in your book, that the wealthy consume far more than the poor, low income, and even middle income people. So that's also important. But can you talk about this, about how we are all implicated in these supply chains?
Absolutely. I think that a standard and very commonsensical way to think about mining is that it's the beginning of the supply chain. Like, first you have to get the stuff out of the ground, then you process and refine it, then it enters into supply chains that at the other end spit out the products that we buy, on the market, right? Whether it's an electric vehicle or a solar panel or whatever it is. And that is true to a point, but what that depiction misses is that in some ways, mining is as much the outcome of a set of processes and social and policy decisions and corporate decisions as it is the beginning, right? And so to understand what drives mining in the first place, we can't just start with mining. We actually have to look at the entire supply chain and how that supply chain is organized, because it turns out that what drives demand for raw materials is the kind of entire organization of production and consumption, as you just said, which is profoundly organized by capitalism, by the profit orientation of companies across the supply chain. It's profoundly shaped by wealth inequality. Some people on Earth, we could say, overconsume. They have 5 houses and 4 swimming pools and, their own power systems and can even live off-grid, like, these kind of walled-off mansions and gated communities. Those are people that overconsume, but many people on Earth underconsume. They don't have the basics of sanitation or healthcare or energy access, right? So we have to think about not only that modes of consumption and production drive extraction in the first place, but also that all of that is very unequally distributed, including when we look at the mining itself. And what I discovered in writing this book, doing a lot of research on kind of the global organization of mining and extraction, is that the people that are affected by mining are simply not the same people that benefit from the products that mining creates. In general, right? Some of the places that are most affected by mining are also marginalized and low income. And because of those class inequalities that shape consumption, they are, if anything, might be under consuming. They are not the over consumers of the kind of affluent 1%, right? And there are global justice ramifications too, because when we look around the world, a lot of the raw materials, as well as embodied land, labor, and energy in all of the products that we use, comes from the global South. But the global South is precisely the places on Earth that are denied the kind of wealth of the global economy. And also, more to the point with this climate issue and green technologies, are also the places that have contributed the least to the climate crisis. So there's a particular injustice in indigenous communities in Chile, but also indigenous communities in Nevada, paying the price for lithium mining when they contribute almost nothing to the climate crisis itself. And instead, that crisis is driven by much larger economies, by large companies, and by the overconsumption and the large carbon footprints of the global wealthy. And so I think we need to grapple with each of these injustices and inequalities that can be within a country, across countries. They can be related to class and also in identity when we think about the marginalization of indigenous groups. When we think through the kind of opposite, like what would a just supply chain look like? What would it mean to have supply chain justice at the heart of the energy transition?
To that point, you write that North America, Western European, and wealthier Asian countries consume 3 to 4 times as much as these metals as the world average. We're talking about iron, aluminum, copper, zinc, lead, and nickel. Measured in terms of final consumption, 20% of the global population gobbles up 60 to 75% of the 6 metals, while the bottom 20% accounts for only 1%.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought up that specific statistic, which is a great illustration of what I was just saying, and maybe allows me to bring in another concept that I take from other scholars and thinkers in the global South, which is unequal exchange. That's the fact that raw materials, a lot of them come from the global South. They are exported to the world economy. Very little of the profits or revenues or kind of value of those raw materials stays in the country. Those profits are captured usually by multinational companies. And then on the flip side of that, these countries import the very products made with their own raw materials, right? And so you're kind of on the losing end of a deep inequality in the global system that dates to colonialism, which is when a lot of these kind of economic relationships and geopolitical relationships were first forged. That's exactly why many societies in the global South want to do really two things. And I'm generalizing a lot, you know, at the risk of homogenizing a lot of different places from Africa to Latin America to South Asia. I'll just give listeners a sense of what some of the goals of communities and societies are to change this. One is for sure way better environmental regulation of extraction, including that many communities don't want the mining project to happen at all, right? So that invites interesting and difficult questions over who makes the decision over mining. But if the mining does happen, most communities want it to be much better regulated environmentally. But they also want something else, which is to share in the wealth and benefits of the global economy and to share in the technological innovation that these raw materials are fundamental to creating. And so that means we don't just want to think about governing mining better, but redistributing access to climate technologies that everyone in the world so essentially needs and are to this day remain unequally distributed around the world.
Today on Your Calls One Planet series, we are spending the hour with Thea Rio Francos. She has a very important new book out called Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. She writes, lithium is essential to addressing the climate crisis. It's a key ingredient in the rechargeable batteries that play a starring role in eliminating carbon emissions from transportation and energy, the two highest emitting sectors. But extracting this lithium will come at escalating social and environmental costs. And the question she asks is one that we should always ask and really when we're talking about these issues, is it possible to save the world by harming it in the process? Thea Riofrancos is political science professor at Providence College. She's strategic co-director of the Climate and Community Institute. That's a progressive climate and economy think tank. And her new book is called Extraction: The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. So taking a step back and looking at lithium mining, which countries have the most amount of lithium reserves?
So the highest lithium reserves are actually in Chile, to the extent that, you know, Chile still has only extracted a subset of what it could extract, which is precisely at issue in Chile as multiple successive governments have sought to expand lithium mining. But lithium, the number one lithium reserves are in Chile. Those are the largest. And beyond that, there are actually lithium reserves in lots of places on Earth, right? Nearby to Chile, we have lithium reserves in Argentina and Bolivia. We have lithium in the US. There's lithium in Europe. There's quite a bit of lithium in Central Africa. In other countries in South America, like Brazil, Canada, you know, the list goes on. You know, what's important for listeners to know is maybe two facts that I'll kind of juxtapose. One is that there are four major lithium producers right now that account for the overwhelming majority of lithium that, you know, would go into any electric vehicle or lithium battery. Those are Australia, Chile, China, and Argentina. Those are the top four lithium producers. But as I just mentioned, lithium is actually relatively abundant in the Earth's crust. And you even mentioned, you know, the low concentration in ocean waters. And I had previously talked about underground brine. So lithium comes in all these different forms, rock, clay, liquid, et cetera. It's really spread out around the world. And what we're seeing right now is a lot of governments endeavoring to put their country on that list of top producers. So we have growing production in Zimbabwe, in Brazil, in Canada. You know, over the next few years, one of those countries might become a top five producer or top 10 producer. And so this is not just like a far away thing or like there's one exotic place on Earth where all the lithium comes from. This is increasingly going to happen on every continent and in many countries. And the US is very much included, as we have lithium mines under construction right now in Nevada, as well as one already existing lithium mine in the same state.
You write that skyrocketing demand means more mines. Benchmark Mineral Intelligence estimates that between meeting global lithium demand in 2035 will require between 59 and 74 new and fully operational lithium mines. The exact number depends on recycling capacity. Looking at a range of minerals required for battery production, the analytics firm predicts between 336 and 384 entirely new mines will need to be built and in production by 2035 to satisfy global demand for lithium, graphite, cobalt, and nickel. I mean, these are major, huge numbers.
Yeah, the numbers are really staggering. And they also just give us insight into just the planetary scale and enormous physical footprint of the mining sector we already have. And all of these, you know, the 384 new mines just for electric vehicle batteries in the next decade, that's on top of like many, many, many hundreds of mines that already exist, right? So we're not starting from zero. We're starting from about 70,000 square kilometers of Earth are covered in mines. And that doesn't count the broader area around every mine where environmental impacts can be acutely felt. You know, sometimes 10, 20 miles away from the mine, we are still going to see that contamination, the biodiversity disruption, and social conflicts around mining. So it's a really huge number. I mean, I think that in order to grapple with the full ethics of this question, we of course have to compare that as well to the enormous amount of fossil fuel extraction that happens on a daily basis just to provide the fuel that's ultimately just burned away as we combust, you know, gasoline in order to, you know, drive an ordinary car. So, you know, it's not to say at all that the existing system that we might call fossil capitalism doesn't involve a lot of mining. It does. That mining is even like more preposterous because once we mine fossil fuels, we just combust them and they can't be reused. The benefit of mining for renewable energy supply chains is with those end-use products, solar panels or wind turbines or lithium batteries, we can recycle them. We can recover the minerals from them. That is amazing and presents opportunities for what we could call a more circular economy. The problem and the catch is that we are not setting up the recycling infrastructure that's necessary to take full advantage of the circular potential of the energy transition. That's one big issue. And as you mentioned, like, it varies a lot how much mining we need in the future, whether we set up that recycling today or not. The other thing I'll mention is that all of this type of extraction is happening simultaneously, and that's what makes it so tragic in terms of the biosphere and the atmosphere and the human communities that live on this earth and all of our non-human, you know, friends among various animals and species, which is that they're being subjected to relentless fossil fuel extraction. Like, the fossil fuel extraction continues apace despite the alarming trends of accelerating global warming. Now that's being added to with more and more critical minerals mining for the energy transition. It would be one thing if we were keeping all the fossil fuels underground and transitioning to a new system where we needed mining at the outset, but we could circularly kind of recycle it later on. Instead, we're getting more of all types of extraction because we're not really doing an energy transition yet. We are doing what scholars call an energy addition, where we have more of all types of energy and all of the extraction that they might require. And so that, I think, makes this a more harmful process. You have sometimes the same communities or landscapes subjected to fossil fuel extraction and new forms of critical minerals mining because we're not wholly transitioning from one to the other.
Before we go to break, Thea, can you elaborate on what you just said earlier about why recycling is not being put in place given where we are today, just recycling plastics and this plastic crisis that we're in?
Yeah.
And then who makes these decisions, first of all? And why don't we have the ability to recycle these batteries, given what we know?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought in plastics recycling, which is a very different process. And the contrast is instructive. I know we're going to a break soon, so I'll try to keep it concise. But to be really blunt about it, plastic recycling is basically not real. I mean, and I hate to say that because I recycle my plastic because I'm a do-gooder environmentalist and I put it in the recycling bin. But when you read the research, it's very concerning that we really are not recycling plastics to the degree that the industry claims that we are. And plastic recycling itself is a polluting process and very chemical intensive. And it's really, we need to eliminate plastics as much as possible, single-use plastics especially. And just so everyone knows, plastics are made from oil. They are a petrochemical derivative. And so the plastic industry supports the fossil fuel industry. They're connected to one another. So we really need to get off of plastics because they're very hard to recycle well. On the other hand, to be positive, lithium batteries can be recycled much better, or maybe a better way to put it is that the minerals within them can be fully recovered. In a laboratory setting, you can get 99% of the lithium out of a battery once that battery has kind of reached the end of its life. So that's very promising. The thing is that recycling needs to be something that the government supports with policies. Recycling is in some ways like a public good. That doesn't mean that private companies can't set up recycling plants. They do. But really, to get the impetus for recycling, including for manufacturer responsibility, to make sure that battery manufacturers are responsible if their batteries are not recycled, and also are asked to use more and more recycled materials instead of new mined materials. We need government intervention, and they're doing this in Europe, and I hope it pays off. This is a new European policy just from a couple of years ago to massively incentivize recycling, battery recycling in Europe. China already recycles at higher rates, but not enough. And the US is lagging. And so we need to set up those collection infrastructures, producer responsibility, incentives to use recycled materials over new mining today. So then 10 years when your electric car or 15 years electric car is at the end of its life, that battery doesn't go into a landfill, which is very dangerous because batteries can be toxic and hazardous. We need to get them into safe recycling collection facilities so the minerals can be fully recovered. And then we would mine less, which would be an amazing outcome.
And you talk about that at the end of your book, which we'll discuss after a break. Today, we're joined by Thea Riofrancos, author of the new book, Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. Thea explores the environmental and social costs of the race to embrace green solutions like electronic cars by expanding lithium mining. Thea Riofrancos is political science professor at Providence College, strategic co-director of the Climate and Community Institute, and she asks if it's possible to save the world by harming it in the process. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Professor Thea Riofrancos. We're talking about her new book, Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. She traces the history of global extraction and examines how lithium mining harms landscapes, provokes protests, and takes center stage in national politics. Let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Thanks for holding.
Hi, thank you. I'm Chilean American, and this has been an issue that have we're basically back to square one in terms of Soquimich, the SQM company that is now in contracts or has created a sort of like a partnership with Codelco for lithium mining. Few people know who is behind that company. It was majority shares of the dictatorship of Pinochet. In fact, Ponce Leroux is the son-in-law of Pinochet, and now it's in the hands of the granddaughter of Pinochet. And, you know, few people realize that this issue, especially with regard to the water consumption and the water table, is something that's very, very serious, not only in Chile for Chile, but for the rest of the world. In fact, extraction has been going on in the north for quite some time by the Canadian Barrick gold mine that destroyed the water, the glaciers in the Andes Mountain, which supply water to a very, very dry area. And this is even more dangerous as well. And few people know also that the reason why Evo Morales was overthrown was because Bolivia also has a very rich lithium reserve as well. Those were my comments, and I appreciate any comment that your guest has regarding that.
Yes, thank you so much for that. What are your thoughts on that, Thea?
Yeah, no, so I mean, so much brought up, and maybe I'll just tease out a few points since the person asking is so knowledgeable and you know, in some ways answered the questions themselves. But, you know, Chile is just such a fascinating place to look at, to understand the harms and injustices and long legacies of mining and its relationship to colonialism, to periods of dictatorship and repression, to even, you know, progressive governments like the one right now in Chile that, you know, I think is trying to change the sector, but is also trapped by many of these long processes that date for hundreds of years in terms of Chile's role in the world, being a producer of minerals. And just to kind of name, Chile is the number one source of the world's copper. And as I already said, the number two source of lithium. Copper is also an essential mineral for electrification. All of the wiring that electricity needs, you know, to conduct and be transported is based on copper. And so Chile has this dual role in the energy transition. And for that reason, the politics and social and environmental controversies around mining in Chile are very intense because, as I said, they relate to these longstanding harms, to the ways that a brutal dictatorship from the 70s to 1990 really shaped the sector in the interests of foreign capital, but also nepotism and his own family. And these are not unusual. I mean, this might sound like a weird little anecdote, but mining is notorious for being one of the most corrupt sectors. In addition to the inequalities, there's just sheer corruption of the way that public and private interests get intermeshed, and regulatory capture and moral hazard makes regulation very difficult. And so that, you know, I think the person asking the question is saying, you know, we need to attend to these long-term structural issues that have meant that the benefits of mining in Chile are captured by the very few, even as mining is done now in the name of climate action with the copper and lithium. A lot of these longstanding harms persist, which is why Chilean society has really clamored for a different governance model. And to some extent, and, you know, hard to be nuanced in 2 minutes, and I, you know, want to get to other questions if there are some, but, you know, the current government has made some very bold promises around better regulation, conservation, indigenous rights, and prior consultation, some of which they're making some headway on for sure. On the other hand, there's real concern among a lot of communities because the current government also wants to expand lithium mining beyond the two large mines that already exist. And so you see these, you know, you see the tensions and the dilemmas, and it's hard to, I think, from the perspective of a single global South government, it's hard to change the whole industry yourself. We need to think cooperatively across borders and think across supply chains when we look to more holistic solutions for how to solve these issues.
Well, as you say, that the history is so important, and thank you so much for bringing this in, Lisa. In your fourth chapter, Lithium for Chile, you write about Salvador Allende, Latin America's first democratically elected socialist leader. You write about how he nationalized the country's copper and mining, and it's so important to remember this. You write that prior to nationalization, U.S. companies controlled 80% of Chilean copper production. Those exports, in turn, accounted for the same percentage of the country's foreign exchange earnings. Shortly after Allende won election in 1970, President Nixon vowed to make the economy scream. When Allende seized the property of American mining firms, Nixon had his pretext. Adding insult to injury, Allende's government charged these companies $774 million as restitution for excess profits, and the punishment was swift. In response, the U.S. government withheld bilateral aid, downgraded the country's credit rating, influenced debt negotiations with multilateral banks, and indirectly provided funds to a trucker strike that drove the Chilean economy to a halt. And this chaos provided an opening for dictatorship. So this is all, it's so important to connect all of these dots, Thea.
Absolutely. And, you know, I already mentioned that the mining industry is notorious for corruption. I'll mention a couple other facts that align with the history that you just mentioned. Another is that the mining industry is the most violent sector if we look at violence in terms of the killing and assault and death threats to land and environmental and water defenders. So in other words, when people are peacefully trying to protect their land or even just showing up to a community meeting, maybe they don't know a lot about the mine, but they want to understand it. Maybe some local activists are holding a meeting. A community member shows up, they get death threats later on. There's no industry where more human rights violations, alleged and proven, take place. And so mining has just a long history of violence associated with it that the Pinochet government is, you know, that not only, of course, deposed Allende, the Democratic Socialist government, the Pinochet dictatorship also literally assassinated mine workers who were trying to organize for their rights. And decades later, you know, we see these concerning issues with repression of rights and human rights violations in the sector. And Latin America is the most dangerous place in particular for activists, but activists very valiantly still resist mining, right? So that's another thing to think about. And then, you know, in addition to the violence of the industry and the corruption of the industry, there's the fact that there are a lot of examples, this is not limited to Chile, of mining and extractive industries being involved in military dictatorships, in the overthrow or undermining of democratically elected governments when their interests are harmed. And unfortunately, when we look historically, especially during the Cold War period, there was also often the involvement of the U.S. when it was U.S. multinational corporations whose interests were at stake. And so when people in the present, in a place like Chile, are upset about the impact on water, about the impact on biodiversity, about the impact on indigenous rights, it's not just like a today thing. It's not just like I woke up and I learned about this new harm. There's a long collective memory of layers of violence, corruption, and military dictatorship that have shaped this industry and that are just very live and salient for people. But around the world, when we look at the spread of the industry, this is not just history. Where the industry goes, we tend to see these issues of violence and corruption follow. And so the governance needs to be set up before the boom happens. And that's what's so complicated about the moment we're in. There's a major race to mine, and the boom might unfold before we set up the structures of economic benefit, of equity and justice, of labor rights protections, of human rights protections, to ensure that history doesn't continue to repeat itself.
We should say, as you report in your book, Extraction, of the nearly 200 environmental defenders killed in 2023, 25 were killed for opposing mining projects. The logging industry came in second, accounting for 5 murders. And this is according to Global Witness.
Absolutely. And we should always keep in mind with human rights data that it's most likely an undercount, because in a lot of countries, and this can, you know, include our own, right? But in countries around the world, deaths may not always be attributed to the actual person that is guilty, right? So like maybe there's a mysterious disappearance or a mysterious assault of a human rights activist and the company is never found guilty, or that allegation has never even surfaced, or you don't have the human rights legal infrastructure, as again is the case in a lot of the world, to even know where to report this issue, right? So when we look at those numbers, as concerning as they are, all the human rights experts I spoke to for this book told me it's likely an undercount. So that is even more alarming.
We are speaking today with Thea Riofrancos, author of the new book, Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. Thea Riofrancos is political science professor at Providence College and strategic co-director of the Climate and Community Institute. We have a number of emails about alternatives to lithium. Maureen writes, in the past year, I heard about a lab breakthrough where an alternative to lithium was created. Have you heard about this? And then a related question from Nancy. Thank you for the show. My son is an engineer at Form Energy in Berkeley, where they're creating an iron-based battery. Since iron is the most common mineral in the world and inexpensive, and since the rusting of iron produces energy over and over, this is potentially a useful part of the future of energy. Though the batteries are large, too big for cars, they could work for fleets of vehicles or cities. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. So, you know, there are a lot of different battery technologies out there. For a variety of reasons, lithium has really prevailed for electric mobility as well as like personal electronics. So our laptops and our cell phones, as well as electric vehicles, electric buses, use lithium batteries predominantly. And that's because lithium is so lightweight and energy dense that the weight of the battery doesn't drag down your phone and make it super heavy, right? Or like a car and kind of add to the weight of the car. And so lithium batteries are great for energy density, for power density. They can last relatively long, but there are downsides, right? You know, we've talked a lot about the environmental downsides, but other downsides are that there have been moments where lithium is really costly on global markets and some of these other resources have been cheaper. There's also the issue that, and I mentioned this briefly, lithium batteries themselves can be a bit hazardous and volatile. We've had issues of lithium batteries exploding. Some of these other battery chemistries are more stable. So there's pros and cons. You know, one thing that I like to say to listeners when they ask me this question is that there is no such thing as a free lunch when we are talking about environmental impacts, right? So the question asker asks about iron. I would, you know, encourage folks to look into iron mining, which is like not, you know, the prettiest process, right? And actually has been linked to a number of environmental, pretty acute environmental issues where it happens, right? Similar with sodium batteries. They also come with environmental impacts. So I think that there's like a couple of different issues to unpack. One is like, how abundant is a resource? How expensive or cheap is it? You know, how safe is it to use? How energy dense? Those are the parameters that chemists kind of look at when they figure out what's the best battery technology. But then there's a separate issue, which is what is the environmental impact of each of these different mining sectors? And each of them have their own impacts and harms associated with them. And so I think that we need to think both about chemistry and affordability, as well as about the fact that writ large, the mining industry tends to have a similar pattern of environmental and social harm. So we still have to address that, even if we come up with an even better battery, whether it's lighter weight, whether it's cheaper, whether the resource is more abundant.
Well, thank you for those questions. Martha wanted us to take a look at a Wired piece about sodium ion batteries. Thank you for that, Martha. A couple questions about where we go from here. Sandy writes, I lived in Carson City, Nevada, working at the Nevada State Library doing historical research. Northern Nevada had hundreds of silver mines, but the citizens did not benefit from all of this extraction. The robber barons did, making millions of dollars, taking that money to where they lived in San Francisco. It's the same pattern with lithium. Can you talk about how we can change this historical pattern? We are really talking about a major sea change. David writes, I'm a leftist environmentalist. I am appropriately disturbed by everything your guest is saying, but I'd like to hear a solution to the fact that the world is going to be increasingly and arguably dependent on this kind of mineral as time goes on. So this leads us to your very interesting section, Green Futures. You wrote that you wondered whether a reimagined transportation sector in which many more Americans rode buses or bikes would require the same massive volumes of minerals as one in which every household owned their own electric car. You write, I speculated about the per-person material footprint under distinct mixes of electrified mobility. You thought that someone had already done this work, but to your surprise, you could not find any study. And so you and your colleagues at the Climate and Community Institute took a look at all of this. Tell us about the process and what you found.
Yeah, so I wanna address both of these questions in our remaining few minutes. And I'll start with the one you just asked me, which also one of the listeners brought up. And then I also wanna go to that issue of kind of the economic inequalities that first question also brought up. You know, how can we make sure that communities benefit from this process, you know, based on that comparison to the history of silver mining in Nevada? But you know, on this question about reorganizing supply chains and thinking about how to make them less resource intensive, what we discovered at Climate and Community Institute, that again is a think tank that I work with, and we undertook this big project to say, like, we absolutely need lithium batteries and we absolutely need to electrify mobility. And we need to address the climate crisis like urgently and justly. So we all agree on that. The question is, how do we do it with less mining than the worst case scenarios? Because that all of those numbers you ticked off earlier in our interview, like hundreds of new mines for this or that purpose related to the energy transition, is very alarming. So can we get to the same goal with less extraction? And the answer is a resounding yes. And what was just as impressive about the fact that it was so clear once we did the modeling that we can do this is that no one else had asked this question before, as you said, which I think speaks to how entrenched our ideas about consumption and production and resource use are, that certain questions are not even asked. And so what we found is that even if many Americans drove electric vehicles, understanding that in rural areas or in some parts of the country, like there really isn't must match transit. So even if we don't totally create a utopia in which, you know, there's an electric bus everywhere or no one owns a car, maybe that would be an amazing society, but, you know, we want it to be relatively realistic. So we looked at, if we just reduce how many Americans own cars or use cars versus how many take electric buses or, you know, subways or commuter rails or electric bikes to work or can walk to work, if we made our communities denser in the sense that we have less suburban and exurban sprawl, so it's easier to walk from place to place, if we reduce the size of batteries so we're not buying these enormous electric SUVs, if we recycled all of the batteries and recovered the minerals like we were talking about earlier, if we do all these things, we would need so much less lithium than if we did none of those things, right? And so there are real forks in the road. And also each of these are good for other reasons. It's good for our streets and communities to be walkable. It's good for people to have more transit access options. Let's say your whole household shares one car. It's great if you can take a bus to work, you know, while your partner takes the car, right? There's reduced pollution. There's reduced fatalities if we reduce overall car use. There's so many benefits to these ideas, but they also have this key benefit of reducing how much lithium we would need, because the most lithium is needed if we all individually own cars and we all have enormous cars and we drive them very long distances, right? And so, you know, it's thinking about these different scenarios and how we can put ourselves on a pathway to addressing the climate crisis more quickly while also reducing how much lithium we need. And just in our last couple of minutes, the other question was on a slightly different topic, which is super important, which is not just how do we make our energy transition environmentally friendly, or how do we, you know, swap out, you know, cars for buses, right? Or walkable cities for ones that are hard to walk around. That's super important. But another thing is that economic injustice. Mm-hmm. And as we discussed, the economic injustices are local and they are global. Local communities do not benefit from mining as nearly as much as the shareholders do or the corporate executives do. And globally, we see that time and again, certain parts of the world are slated for mining and receive very little of the benefit. And it's other people elsewhere in the world that capture the benefit and the end use consumption. We need to talk about real community benefits from mining, mandating that, writing that into laws, writing that into contracts and legal agreements so that communities get a portion, an important portion of the revenues generated by the mining and get good, stable, dignified, unionized jobs as well. We also need to think globally that Global South countries over hundreds of years have been robbed of their resources and of their very sovereignty over those resources through military coups and corruption and all the things that we talked about earlier. We need to restore basic sovereignty and rights and kind of global equity, because these are the planet's resources, not the resources of the 1%. So we need to think about how to cooperatively and equitably govern and use these resources within environmental limits.
Thea Riofrancos is political science professor at Providence College, strategic co-director of the Climate and Community Institute, and author of the new book, Extraction, The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. Thea, thank you so much for your important work. I feel like we just scratched the surface of your book. We'd love to have you back to talk more about what you uncovered, especially about China. We'd love to ask you about Trump's war on EVs and wind, and yet they're putting more priority on minerals, so we'd like to talk about that. So we hope you will come back.
I would love to be back. This was a wonderful conversation and great questions from the listeners.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us and thanks for your work. And thank you for your questions and your comments. We'll definitely have Thea back. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.